So, just to explain what is going on here, if you came late, now you all got my message, right? But it starts from my summer student, Calder, who is sitting right here, who read a paragraph in a book by Hatcher, which said something like, the long exact sequence of homology, blah, 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 excision, blah, blah, blah. And it's like one paragraph inside something else. It's not the main thing is other stuff. However, you need to know this one paragraph if you want to understand the proof that he was reading. So I thought about it a little bit, and it's actually, you know, it's a can of worms. You need to learn quite a lot before you understand long exact sequences and who cares about them and homology and who cares about them and excision and who cares about it and all that. And I, as it turns out, I've given a course, a week-long course, about that 7 years ago in Ghana. So I decided to just repeat it here. Now, back when I gave it in Ghana, the advertisement was something like that when I was an undergrad, I remember I loved topology. I really loved topology. I thought topology was wonderful. Like this, what you study in 327, not what you study in 257. 257 is ugly. 327 is the real thing. Sorry, that's what I thought back then. And then I wanted to read about algebraic topology, so I borrowed a book about an algebraic topology from the library and started reading it, and I saw all these huge, incredibly complicated diagrams, and it was completely clear I would never understand that. But eventually I did understand it, so I want to share it with you. Okay? Anyway, so that's the story. Now, I'll pretend that what I want to prove is the Brouwer fixed point theorem. So the formal goal of this week is to prove the Brouwer fixed point theorem. But the actual goal is to go through all the ingredients that go into it. And these are exactly homology, exact sequences, excision, all of that nonsense. So what's the Brouwer fixed point theorem? So I didn't prepare this class, and I will not prepare any of these classes. I don't even know how to spell Brouwer. Brouwer fixed point theorem says the following: any continuous function f from the n-dimensional disk to itself. So I'm assuming that all of this notation is known to everybody. Oh, so sorry. What are the prerequisites? So the prerequisite are having taken 257 with me. Not because there is so much content in there, but because I will use my own language, and I will pretend that you all know it. So people who took 257 with me have seen DN. It's what I use for the n-dimensional disk. Okay? So that's one prerequisite. And the second prerequisite, which is actually possibly harder, is you must know what is the quotient of one vector space by another. If you don't know, sorry, not by another, by a subspace. So in other words, so here are the prerequisites. So one, 257, but again, it's not really, it's the language, it's not really the content. And two, so if W is a subspace of V, you must know what V mod W is. If this scares you, if you don't know how to work with it, I'm not going to do it. This will take too much. It's easy. It's not that it's much. It's just that it means that we will be starting too early. Okay? Now, if you've seen group theory, so if you took, 301, 401, 347, any of these things, maybe you haven't seen it for vector spaces, but you have seen it for groups. So if you have a subgroup H of a group G, actually normal subgroup, then there is something called G mod H. Okay? It's exactly the same. A vector space is in particular an abelian group. So it's really exactly the same. But again, if you have not seen that, it's an hour to explain, maybe 2 hours to explain, but it's a semester to digest, and we don't have that. Okay? Okay, sorry. So back to the Brouwer fixed point theorem. Any continuous function from the n-dimensional to this to itself has a fixed point. FP, standard mathematical language, stands for fixed point. What does fixed point mean? It means that there exists some point x, no, let's call it p because it's a point, inside the n-dimensional disk such that f of p is equal to p. So, if you take an n-dimensional disk, I'm drawing it in two dimensions, but I mean it in n dimensions, and you map it to itself, some point will map to itself. For example, if you take, I hope nobody will hate me for doing this. Let me turn this. So I'm using the disk, but of course I could have used similar surfaces, spaces. So here is an n-dimensional disk, two-dimensional. I'm mapping it to another copy of itself by crushing it. And the claim is that at least one point at the top goes to a point directly, to the same point in the image. Okay? Who cares? So, in general, so why care? So, why care? Well, the main reason is because it's an excuse to study homology. So it's really an excuse. So I don't really care. Okay? The second reason is that, well, you know, it's the fundamental quest of mathematics to solve equations. Right? So here is a situation in which I can prove that there is always a solution. So it's really about solving equations. And the last point that I want to make is that it generalizes the, what is it called? Intermediate value theorem. So the intermediate value theorem. So let me remind you, what does the intermediate value theorem say? It says that if you have a function on the interval from -1 to 1, and it has the property that it is negative here and positive here, then somewhere in between, it, at least in one place in between, it will be zero. Why does it imply the Brouwer fixed point theorem for n equals 1? So let me explain. So at n equals 1, I claim that the intermediate value theorem implies the Brouwer fixed point theorem. Okay? So, proof, by the way, this is informal. This is absolutely informal. The fact that this is on tape doesn't make it less informal. You know, I'm making faces to the tape. Okay? It's not really. In particular, ask question, throw chalks at me. Just, you know, it's not. If you misbehave, it's not going to affect your mark.
Silly question.
Yes.
The crumpling, is that a continuous?
Yeah, I meant continuous, right? Of course. So, but crump. Oh. But it's not smooth. Crumpling is definitely continuous. In fact, it's worse than, it's better than continuous. It decreases distances. Okay? Basically, paper, anything you do with paper decreases distances, because if you try to increase distances, something bad happens. Okay? But it's not smooth. So, like, you know, I mean, it's definitely, it's not, it's continuous but not differentiable. And in fact, here, I mean it when I say continuous and not differentiable. The theorem is actually significantly easier in the differentiable case. Any other thing? Okay. Again, make a mess. This isn't about... Okay. So, proof. So, I have my function f, and I want to solve the equation. So, again, but again, this is an informal class, so I'm going to make it not full, not complete. So, given f, I want to solve the equation f of x is equal to x. The intermediate value theorem is not about f of x is equal to x, it's about something is equal to zero. So let me move the x to the other side and define a new function g of x such that g of x is equal to f of x minus x. And what I want is to solve for x's that satisfy f of x minus x is equal to zero, namely g of x is equal to zero. Now, f is defined on the interval from minus 1 to minus 1, to 1, right? And it takes values in the same interval. That's somehow the one-dimensional ball. The one-dimensional disk is just the interval from minus 1 to 1. So let's compute g of negative 1. So let's compute g here and g here. So g of negative 1 is f of negative 1 minus minus 1, which means plus 1. But this is... and this is a number between minus 1 and 1, and we add 1 to it, so the result is greater than or equal to 0. G of 1 is f of 1 minus 1, but again, this is a number between minus 1 and 1, and we subtract 1, so it's less than or equal to 0. So the conclusion is that the picture is exactly the opposite of what I said, namely, it starts above 0 and goes to below 0, but again, the intermediate value theorem still holds. And the conclusion is that there exists an x as we want. Questions, comments? Okay, good. So, one more thing. I'm actually not going to prove the Brauer fixed point theorem, but I'm going to prove an equivalent statement. Okay? So, my first theorem, or maybe my second, given that that was maybe the first, is that the Brauer fixed point theorem, in any dimension n is equivalent to a different statement, which is the one we will actually prove. And it says, the different statement says that there does not exist. Okay, so again, sorry for the short notation, but I think it's clear. Okay, so there does not exist a so-called retract of SR of the n-dimensional disk to the n-1 dimensional sphere. And the problem with this theorem is that I haven't defined a retract yet. So let me define a retract. So definition, if A inside X is a subspace of a topological space, so if you took 327, you know what the word topological space means. If you didn't take 327, every time I say topological space, replace it by metric space. It doesn't matter. It's the same. It's not the same, but for our purposes, it's as good. Okay? So if A is a subspace of a topological space, a retract R from X to A is a continuous map which does not move, which moves all of X to A, but does not move the point of A, such that, in other words, such that R of A is equal to A for every A inside A. Alternatively, so a different way to write it is to say the following. So whenever you have, how do I want to do it? This way. So whenever you have A, which is a subspace of X, you automatically have an inclusion map from here to here. It's just a map that does nothing. It's the function that does nothing. Let us call it I for inclusion. Okay? Now, a retract will be a map from X to A. Right? A retract goes from X to A. And of course, I mean continuous. And the property R of A is equal to A for points in A just means that if you start here, go to here, and then go to here, you've done nothing. What does it mean that you've done nothing? It means that if you put here the identity map, then this triangle commutes. Have you seen the phrase a triangle commutes before? I think you have, even in my 257, so it's a formal prerequisite to this series. But the meaning of the word, the triangle commutes, and later the square commute, the diagram commutes, the horrible, crazy picture of maps and spaces and maps between them commutes. The meaning of that is if you go from one place to another place, it doesn't matter which way you go, you always get the same answer. In our case, it means going this way is the same as going that way, which means exactly this condition. Okay? So what does it mean in our... So this is the general definition. Let's specialize for Dn and Sn minus 1. So here is Dn. This is Sn minus 1. A retract would be a continuous function which maps every point of Dn to a point of Sn. So basically it takes the disk and its inside to the boundary. It has to be continuous, and it has to leave points of the boundary in place. If I didn't insist that you leave points in the boundary in place, would there be a such a... It will not be a retract. What should we call it? I don't know. Detract. Would there be a detract if the definition didn't include this condition? Just that it would... I just wanted a map from X to A, but not necessarily keeping the boundary in place. Would you be able to do that?
Yeah.
What would you do?
You first map everything to the middle and then you drag it to the boundary.
Well, or alternatively, you just crash everything to some point on the boundary.
Yeah.
Right? But that's a detract, that's not a retract. The retract is everything goes to the boundary. Intuitively, it's clear that you cannot do it. Right? My goal, because you'd have to tear it somewhere. My goal is to, you're welcome to try to prove that you cannot do it. You'll find that it's extremely difficult, and my goal is to prove it. Okay? Anyway, so now I've defined the notions inside this theorem, so we can start, so we can prove it. Again, this is still preliminary, it's not yet even algebraic topology, it's just the, okay? So proof of theorem. Oh my God. How do you do that? So, I think theorems, if and only if theorems, have two directions usually. So let me claim that Claim, if there exists a counterexample to the Brouwer fixed point theorem, then there is a retract. Okay? So in other words, if there exists a function f from Dn to Dn with no fixed point, then there exists a retract. Okay? Proof. Okay, so I mean this is the first side of the proof. So I think I'll do it only in pictures. So suppose I had a function which maps every point x to some other point. Okay, so to some point f of x like this. Okay, but the key point is that x is that f of x is never x itself. So what you can do is you can start construct a line starting at x, a straight line starting at x, going through f of x and going to the boundary. And then the retract at the point x will be the point where that line meets the boundary. So we define r of x to be the point at which the interval x to f of x, this interval meets the n minus of the boundary, so the n minus one dimensional sphere. Okay? Okay. First of all, I use the fact that f has no fixed point. If f had a fixed point, then f of x would be on top of x. I wouldn't know which way to go. Okay? Second, the result is continuous. It's kind of easy to imagine it, right? If f was continuous, then the result would be continuous. But why is it continuous? Basically because I could write it in a formula. I wrote it as a picture, but you know, if I was patient enough, I could write, take this vector, subtract this vector, normalize, I don't know, some closed formula. The moment you write something as a formula, it means that it's continuous. Provided there is no division by zero or something, and there isn't a division by zero because it's well-defined. Okay? So it's continuous. Three, it's a retract. Why? It maps every point to a point in the boundary, by definition. And if a point is in the boundary, so if x is here, it doesn't matter where f of x is. F of x here could be here, could be... It doesn't matter where it is. The interval from x to f of x will meet the boundary at x. Yes?
Oh, sorry, I think in your definition, the arrow goes reverse, right?
Yeah, I should have taken the arrow going the other way. Right.
Going
so,
from f of x to x.
Right, f of x to x, you're right. So basically, I want in this case to select this point and not the other point where the interval meets the boundary. Yeah, you're right. Sorry, I had it wrong. Okay, so this is one direction. And the second direction is the second direction. So suppose now there exists a retract. I need to show you that there is a function with no fixed point. So if there is a retract, I need to show that there exists f with no fixed point. So again, I'll do it by a picture. This one is even easier. Suppose I had a retract r. So every point goes to a point in the boundary. Okay? And points in the boundary stay in place. So define f to be the function r, the retract, followed by... Here's notation I never used, I think, in 257. Did I? So, you know, mathematicians have this annoying convention that if you have three spaces, x goes to y goes to z, and you have a function f going from x to y, and a function g going from y to z, then the composition is called g circle f. And it's designed to make us unhappy because like you go from left to right and then you write from right to left. It's designed to be unreasonable. So as a public service to the community, I'm trying to introduce the notation. Instead of this notation, use the notation f double slash g. F double slash g means do f then do g, which is this done right. Okay? So in this class, I will mostly use this notation. Okay? So f will be the retract followed by rotation by 257 degrees. Why 257? Why not? So you see, every point on the inside goes to a point on the boundary. After rotation by 257, it's still a point on the boundary. So it's not a fixed point. It went somewhere else. Points on the boundary stay in place under the retract, but then get rotated by 257 points, 200 degrees. 250 degrees, 257 is not equal to 360, and so they don't come, and so they're not fixed points either. So this is the end of our first two theorem. Yes?
Well, I mean, some rotations might have fixed points on the boundary.
What?
So some rotations might have fixed points on the boundary.
Nope. Rotation? The only way a rotation will have a fixed point is if it's the do-nothing rotation. Rotation by 0 or 360 or... Rotation means just rotate. How would the point on the boundary stay in place?
So you take a sphere and a rotation and two fixed points.
Yeah.
Oops. Sorry, what have I done? I wasn't thinking. This is in the plane. This is only in the two-dimensional case. You are absolutely right. I'm absolutely wrong. So if there is a retract, there is a
map everything to its antipodal point or something?
Sorry?
Could you map everything to its antipodal point?
I suppose that would work, yeah. That's a better idea, sorry. So, thank you, and I'm sorry. So, sorry. Thank you. So instead of this, do x goes to minus x. So every point goes to its opposite. Now there are no fixed points. Okay. Okay. Good. Okay. Okay. Let me... sorry. So part of the thing about... taking blackboard shots is that I need to pause every few minutes to take... Oh, sorry. Last picture I took was a selfie. I'm sorry.
Make sure it doesn't pause.
Okay. So I want to tell you what's the key to the proof. So the key to the proof is perhaps the most important idea in algebraic topology. And it's the following. So what we want is a so-called functor. So what we want is a functor, and I will have to define what a functor is, and this will come later. So we want a functor from topology topology to algebra. So you know, a function takes a space to a space. A functor takes a discipline to a different discipline. Okay. But I will make it more precise in a minute. But we have here a problem in topology. Given S minus 1 included into Dn, we want to ask ourselves, is there a map R, is there a retract R into Sn minus 1 such that this would be the identity. Okay? This is a question about topological spaces. The functor we want will turn this diagram of topological spaces to a diagram of vector spaces, or groups, or it doesn't really matter. It will turn it into a problem of the following type. So in fact, I don't just want a functor, I want a good functor. I want a functor with extra properties. So in fact, let's call this functor Hn minus 1. And let me tell you what I want this functor to do. I want it to do two things. First of all, I want it to have that Hn minus 1 of Sn minus 1 is equal to the ground field. Okay? So the ground field, if you want, you can call it F. If you want, you can call it the real numbers, but then I really wouldn't approve because the real numbers really have nothing to do with this the algebra side of the story. Or you can, well, I said you need to know what's the quotient of one vector space by another, but I didn't really mean a vector space. I really meant a so-called module. A module is a vector space over a ring instead of over a field. So it's basically the same definition. The notion of quotient still makes sense, the only difference is that instead of having a ground field, you have a ground ring. So in the scalars, you're talking about the integers instead of over a field, okay, or something like the integers. So I want this property, and the second property that I want is kind of is actually easier. So I want that the dn will go to zero. And then the whole picture, once you apply this functor from topology to algebra, becomes, well, Sn minus 1 becomes z. dn, right, because that's one of the properties that I wanted, dn becomes zero. The zero-dimensional vector space, or the group with the module with only one element, the element zero. Okay. The other Sn minus 1 becomes z, and I didn't yet formally define a functor, but when I will define it, I will want it to have the property that not only it maps spaces to vector spaces or to groups, okay? But furthermore, I will want it to map maps to map to homomorphisms. So continuous maps to homomorphisms. So there should be, there will be a homomorphism here. I am asking myself, is there a homomorphism here? And one further property that functors will have is that the identity should go to the identity. So between here and here, there is just the identity map from Z to Z. Okay? Now this is absurd. In the world of algebra, there is no map, the identity map from Z to Z doesn't factor through zero. Right? The moment you went through zero, it's not one-to-one anymore, it's not going to be an isomorphism. So in the world of algebra, this is absurd. And so, if I am able to find a functor with these properties, then this is absurd too. And therefore, there is no retract, and therefore the Brouwer fixed point theorem is true. So my current goal is, after defining what a functor is, find such a functor. So something that will map topology to algebra and will have this property. Okay? And this is somehow the subject of algebraic topology. That's what algebraic topology does. Okay. Okay, now let's turn this into formal definitions. So first of all, I need to tell you, what a functor is. A functor goes from a discipline to another discipline, right? It goes from a whole discipline to another whole discipline. So I need to define what's a discipline, okay? A discipline in this language is a category. It's called a category. So definition, a category, by the way, how many of you know what a category is already? Okay, it's fair, I really don't know, well, again, this really is an informal series, okay? So anyway, what's a category? A category is a collection of so-called objects. So topological spaces, groups, vector spaces, rings. We'll have other examples later. So in fact, let me give the category name, so calligraphic C. So this collection is often called the collection of objects of C. By the way, if you are pedantic, then you'll notice that I said a collection of objects and not a set of objects. Because within set theory, because categories are somewhat external to set theory. Like, because I want even the collection of all sets to be to make a category. And then I would have to, and then the objects will be the set of all sets. But if you've seen set theory, you know that this is something you want to stay away from. So there is sort of a way around it, and it's to replace the word set by the word collection, and it actually has a different meaning. It's not just linguistics. It actually does mean something slightly different than an ordinary set. But in your mind, you should be just thinking the set of all sets. Okay, or the basically a big collection of objects. Okay? So it's a collection of objects. Two, for any two objects, so for any two objects, A and B, inside the collection of objects of the category, I want a set And this actually is genuinely a set, though it really doesn't matter, I mean, at this level, okay? And this set is called the set of morphisms. Maybe you would add here a subscript to indicate morphisms in this universe between A and B. So I should give. So the set is the set of so-called the elements of these sets are called morphisms from A to B. And then there is a little bit of further information, but before giving you the further information, I want to give a few examples. Okay? So, examples. So the first example is C equals to so-called set. And maybe I should have used a different font. Often in books it appears in different fonts. I mean, so I don't know. Maybe, I don't know. Okay? So what are the objects? The objects are simply sets. Or more precisely, the collection of objects is the collection of all sets. And again, since this symbol is usually reserved for sets, so in some sense what I'm saying is meaningless, so I mean, I'll underscore it. But I really mean all sets, okay? And then if A and B are sets, then the morphisms from A to B are the collection of all, the set of all functions from A to B. If A and B are specific sets, then the set of all functions between them is again a set. Okay? Example two, C is vect. So the objects are vector spaces. By the way, the set of vector spaces doesn't make sense just as much as the set of sets doesn't make sense, right? Because, you know, even the set of vector spaces with one element doesn't make sense because that element, namely, it has to be zero. No, it's sorry, a vector space is over a specific field, over some specific field F. So really I should have called it vector sub F. So sorry, the zero-dimensional vector spaces do make sense, but the one-dimensional vector spaces no longer make sense. Because you can declare that that one dimension is any set whatsoever, is multiples of any set whatsoever. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I'm still thinking of it as if it makes sense. And then the morphisms between any two objects, maybe now I should use standard notation, so V and W will be the set of linear transformations L going from V to W. So basically structure-preserving maps from V to W. Okay? Three, C is equal to groups. Yeah?
Is there a condition about the existence of identity morphism?
Yes, there is. I didn't finish the definition. Okay? The third category is the category of groups. So the objects are all groups. And the morphisms are group homomorphism. Morphisms. Next example, C could be Smooth manifolds. So what should we call it? I don't know what. Man. Okay? So the objects are smooth manifolds, and the morphisms are smooth maps between them. Smooth maps. And so on, you know, every course that you took has some category hidden in it. Okay? In fact, there are more examples, including examples that don't at all look like that. And some of them we will see in this class. And maybe the example number 5 I will show you in a few minutes, but maybe first let me complete the axioms. Okay? So, what are the further axioms? So, as Siddharth indicated, in all of these cases, there is the identity. Okay? So, for every A, we are given a special element, an element, let's call it I sub A, which is a morphism from A to itself. Right? I didn't yet tell you what it does. In what sense is it identity? Well, you cannot even speak of the properties of an identity before you speak about composition. So in fact, the more interesting piece of structure is the following. Given A, B, and C, which are objects, there is a map which takes morphisms from A to B cross morphisms from B to C. So whenever you have a morphism from A to B and a morphism from B to C, you can form a morphism from A to C. And the map is itself called composition. It's the composition map. Okay? If you have functions between sets, you can compose them. If you have functions between linear transformations between vector spaces, you can compose them, and the result is again a linear transformation. I'll skip groups. The composition of two smooth maps is a smooth map. I think we've proven it in 257. Okay? Okay, and then there are properties. So, four, such that, so, okay, so far this is structure. So far, a category consists of that much information. The information is a collection of objects. For any pair of objects, morphisms between them, and a rule how to compose two morphisms, and a special morphism called the identity inside the set of morphisms from anything to itself. And then the rules are as follows, and I'll write them in short, and you will have to interpret them in full. So, rule number A, if you compose F with G, and then compose the result with H, then the result is the same as composing F with the composition of G and H. Basically, you've seen it for functions, right? If you have four spaces and three functions between them, right? So if you have space 1, space 2, space 3, space 4, and you have a function from here to here, a function from here to here, a function from here to here, then composing this and then going over all is the same as composing that and then going over all, right? So that's this rule here. again, I could write it formally, I'm just not bothering. Okay? And rule number B is composing with the identity is the do-nothing map. So let me write it informally first. Composition with the identity this way, or composition with the identity that way, does nothing. And more formally, so this is schematically, but more formally, if F is a morphism from A to B, then, okay, if I compose on the right, so after doing F, I want to do the identity, it would be the identity of B. Then this is the same as doing nothing, as F itself. Alternatively, I could do the identity of A and then F. So IA and then F. Okay? Okay. So, by the way, category theory has the property that the first time you see it, you think it's the most boring thing ever. And it basically says nothing except so for giving a common name for things we all know. But first of all, giving a common name is useful because we're going to have many such situations. And secondly, later it turns out that there are many examples of categories that aren't exactly of this type. So I want to give you one further example of a category which isn't at all like that. And this is the following. The so-called fundamental... Have you seen fundamental group? How many of you have seen the fundamental group? Okay, so many of you. If you took 327, likely you've seen the fundamental group of a topological space. But now I will talk about the fundamental group, groupoid, of a topological space X. Okay? So, and by the way, I say topological space. If you don't like topological space, think metric spaces. You lose nothing by thinking metric spaces. So, let's call it pi 1 of X. And you can complain that the notation clashes with fundamental group. But it really doesn't. For the fundamental group, it's not enough that you'll have a space. You need a space and a base point. So the full notation in the case of fundamental group is pi 1 of x and b. I am not choosing a base point. So I just call it pi 1 of x. And then the result is not a group, but a category. Okay? So what is this? So the objects are simply the points of X. So, it's the set X turned to a collection. Okay? So it's actually a set theoretic category. So it's the points of X. And now I need to tell you what are the morphisms between two points X and Y, where X and Y are both points of the space X. So these are, by definition, continuous paths from the point X to the point Y. So continuous maps gamma from the interval 0, 1 into our topological space X, such that gamma of 0 is equal to X, and gamma of 1 is equal to Y. So the image you should have is, if this is the topological space, I have two points here at X and Y. The morphisms between them are lines, paths that go from here to here, and I'm lying to you, because I have to mod out by homotopy the same way as in the fundamental group. So modulo homotopy, or even more precisely, modulo endpoint preserving homotopy. So modulo motions of paths that do not change the endpoint. So basically, if you can move this path into that one in a continuous manner without moving the endpoints, you consider the two paths equivalent. It's not always the case that you can do it. So for example, if the space is a torus, and the point X is here, the point Y is here, then I can easily find paths that are not homotopic to each other. So this one would be one morphism. This one would be a completely different morphism. And I probably could find more, like I could go down to here, then behind, and then come back here. Okay, so there might be many, many morphisms between any pair of points. Okay? Now, to complete the structure, I need to tell you what is composition. So, composition, right, what is the... So, in all of the previous examples, composition was a composition of functions. This is not a composition of functions. It's a composition of paths. So if you have a path from X to Y and a path from Y to Z, you can turn it into a single path going from X to Z. Okay? What is the identity? The identity of X is the path that stays at X and never moves. You just stay at X and don't move. And then you can verify these properties, but they are not entirely trivial. So composition of paths is not associative. It's only associative after you mod out by homotopy. Likewise, the identity composed with a path is not the do-nothing. It's do-nothing after homotopy. So I will not do all of this, because if you've done it in 327, it's more or less the same. That's it. Okay. Okay, so the time now is 6 and 7 minutes. Should we take a break or just go straight? What does this mean? Break or not break? Yeah, you know, people should have washroom time. And so let's take a 10-minute break and then proceed.